I feel very privileged and honored to speak in front of you today, seeing some familiar faces of people who came and I met at Leicester Conference or at Belgirati or on other group relation conferences. And I've never yet worked in the USA on a group relations conference. And in preparation for today's talk, and also to participate in the symposium, I went back to the group relations reader to read a few chapters. Also spoke to some of my colleagues who've been around long enough to remember those early days. I then decided to go into some of the Tavistock's archives, and I brought with me some of the early AKRI brochures. And I'm going to actually circulate them so you can just keep them and have a look. I think for some of you, it would just be something about the history and the development of AKRI, and some of you might feel a little nostalgic when you look at them. I intend to link my talk to the title of the symposium, Questioning the Place and Timeliness of Group Relations Conference and Other Application Work in the World Today, a Resurgery of Group Relations Using My Experience of Directing the Leicester Conference, and also applying a slightly different angle on our usual way of talking, as you can see from my title. I will start from a brief description of where the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations is today, because I think that the Institute, as the Institute's chief executive and the director of Leicester at the same time, what happens in one is intricately linked to what happened in the other. The Tavistock Institute of Human Relations today is best described as a not-for-profit social science enterprise dedicated to the study of human relations for the purpose of bettering working life and conditions for all humans within the organizations, communities, and broader societies. This is actually the mission statement on our charitable status. And you might remember that unlike AKRI, it's not a membership organization, it's an employing organization. The Institute's body of employees consists of a wide range of social science educated practitioners who come from psychology, philosophy, anthropology, sociology, psychotherapy, social economics, organizational studies, political science, publishing, studies of arts, including history of art and creative arts, and more recently, social media. The Tavistock Institute has a history of working with organizations and sectors that are required to look at systemic questions to achieve greater and more effective change. One way of describing its raison d'etre, if you like, is to improve insight and provide opportunities for learning so that quality of conversation and engagement is improved across organizations and their communities. You can immediately see that the method of group relations is at the heart and soul of this task, which can also be described as to go beneath the surface of tensions and conflict in order that deeper fears and aspirations are worked through and people feel that they are adding value to and having more ownership of the organizations and the communities they serve and are part of. The forces that affect individual and collective behaviors are drawn out whilst holding in mind notions of complex systems as well as institutional resistances and defenses. You can see that it is an ongoing grappling which to an extent can never be resolved and is continually negotiable, debatable, political, changeable, movable. So why do we do this work, consulting and participating in group relations in a task which is relentlessly inconclusive? Margaret Ryok's question from 1985, that's the second group relations volume, reader volume, Why I Work as a Consultant is the name of a paper, is still a relevant question, I think. Probably will be an ongoing question to ponder about for the next 40 years, if not more, of group relations work. And in this talk today, I would like to give you a simple, straightforward, and possibly slightly unusual reply to this question. Because group relations method is a work of art, because it is a collective work of art which emerges in the here and now, is entirely dependent upon the involvement and engagement of participants that constitute it in their different roles, because in group relations we must involve both our passion and our intellect, our spiritual unknowing selves as well as our rational knowing beings, because of the sense of kinship and community that has developed around the world across the group relation organizations and its individual practitioners. Because what we create together in group relations conferences is simply quite beautiful, albeit always painful and difficult. Its beauty also is in it being temporary creation, yet lasting and memorable at the same time. And it has to be recreated in the here and now, a bit like a piece of music. I suggest that group relations is an art which emerges as an aesthetic practice in the here and now work of the conference as a temporary institution, and it is this quality that gives it, at least in part, its long-lasting impact, its broad application capacity, and also its charm, its appeal. You might even think of it as its magnetism. As you know, art and aesthetics are extensively written about. In my talk, I will draw only on a selection of philosophers, artists, and scholars who have conceptualized and theorized about this concept. Leo Tolstoy, the famed Russian novelist, discussed what is art in a paper of this title, where he argues that in order to correctly define art, it is necessary, first of all, to stop considering it as a means to pleasure, which is one of the most commonplace definitions of art, and to consider it as one of the conditions of human life. Every work of art, he says, causes the receiver to enter into a certain kind of relationship, both with him who produces or is producing the art, and with all those who simultaneously, previously or subsequently, receive the same artistic impression. It is upon this capacity of man to receive another man's expression of feelings and experience those feelings himself that the activity of art is based. Art, for Tolstoy, is a medium for communicating and evoking feelings. I think this is a wonderful description of the Group Relations Conference, a medium for communicating and evoking feelings. This definition, then, draws our attention to three important and linked elements. The form, or the artifact, the conference design, including its events, times, breaks, movement to and from different events, and so on. The attitude of the consultants to the work, including their relationship to the members, to the design and to the task. The experience in the here and now practice of the conference temporary institution, its application and implication. I will start with the form, the container, or one key artifact of the group relation artwork, the conference design. Or by extension, you might want to think about the design of an organizational development intervention or a leadership development consultation, which I have discussed elsewhere. Over the last few years, I've become increasingly interested in the process of design and its range of meanings, from planning and structuring based on linear thinking, where a high degree of certainty is assumed, to an increasingly emergent design process, which is more readily linked to art and creativity, to creativity and spirituality, to visceral and bodily responses and observations to do with shape, pattern, flow, movement, space, location, rhythm, and so on. More of that later. I believe that working with the framework of participative emergent design and group relations suits better an uncertain and complex reality of the kind we live in today, or at least willing to experience it as more complex than before, mainly because of technology and globalization, where linear principles do not apply in the same way or are not even very useful. I want to say a few words to differentiate more clearly between linear and non-linear thinking and its application to planning and design. When I talk about linear design, I'm pointing to a particular set of assumptions. An organizational hierarchy where the decision-making is at the top, and so is the accountability, at least where ethical practice is in place, and I think yesterday's talk about the whistleblower might give you the other side of that. Enough certainty to assume that action plan A will lead to result B. Self-belief and self-confidence of the leader at a level of self-sufficiency, or in other words, planning which is centered on the individual. When I talk about emergent or participative design, I'm pointing to a different set of assumptions. An organization which is more aware of its informal hierarchy perhaps has a different image of itself, such as a network, although at the same time would recognize that the formal hierarchy is ultimately the accountability for the results, so is in touch with paradox. Recognizing that there is a high degree of uncertainty around us, which means that our planning might be only incremental, needs to be open to changes and adaptable, and may even require fundamental change to it. To achieve this, we require a culture of collaboration and participation, a leader with enough self-resource and trust in colleagues to know that we can work towards the plan together. In other words, planning which is centered on the system of the group or groups.
Are we behind?
Yeah.
A little bit.
This is what Margaret Riord said in the same paper, or in that paper that I mentioned before, Why I Work as a Consultant. I was going to use the quote of my break.
Next one.
I've done that.
He's emerging at a different rate than you are.
More?
More. One more. There she comes. To my mind, she's talking here about the importance of the design aspect of the conference in being a critical factor in the ability to surface and work for the conference task. Can you read it, or do you need me to read
it?
Here is another quote from Tristan Emery, articulating similar thoughts about participative design as early as 1973 in their book Towards a Social Ecology, Contextual Appreciations of the Future in the Present.
That one it would help if you read.
To succeed in a problem-continuing environment, post-industrial politics must become both more informed and more participative than the politics of industrialism, more devolved and open to more rapid and continuous feedback. Post-industrial man will spend more of his time in politics than industrial man, and more in the planning processes associated with it. He may be presumed to have the leisure. I suppose this is what we offer in a group relations conference, the time out of the daily hamster wheel or the laboratory space to have the leisure to converse in a reflective way, to explore power dynamics and our political selves in a way that pays attention to the details of our engagement and involvement in a context that often feels luxurious and privileged. The designers of a group relations conference need to think about the relationship between the structure of the events and their task, the size of groups and their functions, the location. This is a way of thinking we are used to in designing a conference, time, task, territory. However, what is also called forth in the designer is their attention to movement, the flow from event to event, the spaces between, the pauses, the actions and the rhythmical relationship between them. For example, Daniel Barenboim offered a series of talks in London some years ago where he discussed the process of creating music, particularly through playing all of Beethoven's sonatas over a series of about 12 meetings. In one of those talks, he said that the pauses between the musical notes and the repetitions are just as important for the music as the notes themselves. From actor network theory, that's Latour, we learn that the design can be thought of as an actor in its own right, in itself an active participant in what is being created, so that the aesthetic experience we are having and creating in the group relations context is felt and understood as part of the dialectic between the design in its role as form and container and the members and staff in their roles as humans experiencing and making sense. Hence, another example, in Leicester 2011, the design has been loosened up, or will have been loosened up, to the limits of its necessary framework, and members will be invited to a larger extent than ever to create a conference structure to meet their needs and desires. So, for example, there will be no preconceived subconferences for less or more experienced group relations members. And if the group wishes to have that, they will need to create it in negotiation with staff. You might argue that in a way it's going back to the original working conference design that I've circulated here. I'm attempting a shift from seeing a conference design as only functional in the modern sense of the word. You might remember Charlie Chaplin's film Modern Life, mm-hmm. with a machine that's been created to maximize the efficiency of the brakes of the employees, and he's fed, and of course it's very funny, but very, very functional, to the extent that the person is forgotten about. So, to a design as a key element of the art at work of the group relation experience whose aesthetic expression is through its form. I move now to the second element, attitude. In that same paper, back to Ryok, she says, you can read that one?
Could you please? Could.
The deepest reason why we engage in this work and in similar pursuits is mystical and spiritual. Heaven forbid that we might have anything to do with anything that might be soft, pleasant, and yet, what on earth is our systems theory all about if not the merging of the one in the all? Ryok is expressing a spiritual aspect to group relations, which is often an idealization, or at least this would be the psychoanalytic argument. However, I would argue that the subtext is a proposition about the aesthetics of group relations. Adorno, a German social theorist, criticizes both the idealist theory of art, which has enthralled art to absolute spirit, and psychoanalytic theory of art, which is individually based and hence sees all works of art as projections of the artist. For Freud, the work of art exists only in relation to the individual who contemplates or produces it. From a spiritual perspective, it is the other polarity. The artist, or sometimes the artifact, exists only as a vehicle to express God's beauty. In group relations, we touch on the notion that the aesthetic experience of art comes about through the dialectic between the artist, their materials, and their audience, their groups, whether small or large. I will expand on the point when I discuss the third element, experience, but for now I would like to remain with the attitude and say a bit more about that. Gaston Bachelard, in his beautiful book, The Poetics of Space, draws our attention to the compatibility of phenomenology and psychoanalysis. If you can press it one more so they can see the name of him. Yeah. As a matter of fact, the image has to be understood phenomenologically in order to give it psychoanalytical efficacy. The phenomenologist, in this case, will accept the psychoanalyst image in a spirit of shared trepidation. He will revive the primitivity and the specificity of the fears. In our civilization, which has the same light everywhere, we no longer go to the cellar carrying a candle. But the unconscious cannot be civilized. As a Gestalt therapist, the notions of encouraging the openness to what emerges, what is, and remaining curious without prejudging fit very well here. Gestalt therapy is based on phenomenological philosophy, mm-hmm. and hence requires the therapist to suspend judgment and hold open the curiosity to the phenomenon in front of them as it unfolds in the here and now of the interaction. The working principles also require the Gestalt therapist to bracket their beliefs and work with what is coined as a stance of creative indifference, which is not about being indifferent, that is not caring what happens, but holding open the numerous possibilities for the patients or the group next steps without prioritizing or preferring one to the other on their behalf, not even the patient's well-being. The group relation consultants, as are the members, are invited to approach the group relation experience with this same spirit of inquiry, which is an attitude which both the phenomenologists and the analysts have in common, I think. Bion expresses this attitude in intention and interpretation that the act of faith depends on disciplined denial of memory and desire. For Bion, the act of faith is based on an acceptance of the unknown, since nobody knows what will happen, and it is essentially a spiritual approach to the self. But from his point of view, the act of faith derives from a scientific state of mind and should be freed from its usual religious connotations. In that same book, he draws on letters of the poet Keats, he's here, Keats, who wrote about negative capability, which has since become such an influential idea in our work. Bion quotes from Keats in order to reinforce his idea that the analyst is more able to analyze when he frees himself from the need to understand and make sense. He suggests that the more disciplined the analyst is to release himself from having any possession of memory, desire, understanding, or sense, the more possible it would become for him to work best with what the patient needs. There is a particular leadership attitude which is embedded in these ideas, which is about being artistically engaged. And this is based on the work of John Dewey, who is an American philosopher. And participating in the social process of interaction in local situations, the here and now, without assuming a capacity to step out of or beyond or aside from the interaction. So staffing a group relations conference, and particularly directing one, would be participating in the art of creating without assuming a capacity to know more or beyond or outside of the human interaction, and with a capacity to endure uncertainty and doubt with a touch of humility, as Jack said yesterday, as to one's individual capability. It means that the director and the staff are dependent upon the dialectic between the design principles which have shaped the conference framework or container and the conference members' attitudes and behaviors with each other, with staff and with the design. Dewey argues that the art is ordinary experience expressed, which is the group in the group relations context is where design and attitude meet to give rise to the third element of the work of art, arguably art itself, experience. In talking about experience with art, we need to ask ourselves a couple of questions, again drawing on Dewey. How is it that everyday making of things grows into that form of making which is genuinely artistic? And how is it that our everyday enjoyment of scenes and situations develops into the peculiar satisfaction that attends the experience which is emphatically aesthetic? In the coming together of different people into the group relations space, there is a coming together of different and diverse cultures every time. But there is also a recognizable pattern which emerges as similar every year and gives the group relations conference an air of deja vu or having been here before. Some experiences are experienced as nearly a repeat, the detachment of staff from the members, the walk in the botanical gardens of Leicester, the late nights in the bar, the them and us in the lunch study group, and yet they are also always different. Both these aspects, the sense of having been here before and at the same time being surprised by oneself and by others, create the aesthetic dance of group relations, mostly expressed and communicated through the medium of conversation or dialogue. So I will talk a little bit about the art of dialogue. There is a significant body of literature on the development of theoretical and operational understandings of dialogue in the social sciences, psychology, and utilized in the fieldwork of anthropology. Dialogue has come to mean largely the system of identifying, sharing through speech those ideas, and exploring the emotional dynamics operating at the same time as information sharing. Martin Buber, in 1932, spoke about dialogue as a method for connection, for contact. His theory of relationship requires both separation and connection. That is, it requires a betweenness. For true connection to emerge, one has to be able to participate in the being of another. One cannot instrumentalize the other. The dialogue that Buber describes is a transcendental process. When contacting is in the form of dialogue, the contacting process becomes itself an evolving, spiraling, and developmental process. In other words, as the dialogical process unfolds, one must have faith in one's emerging solutions. There is surrender in the forming moment, rather than an attempt to control what would happen next. In the human interaction, the trust is one's emerging solutions, translates into trust in the between. Genuine dialogue that leads to contact with another person involves entering into dialogue without controlling the other half of it. Other writers on theory of dialogue, for example Richard Heisner, believes that the greatest therapeutic achievement when working in the therapeutic dyad is the restoration of full dialogue. This notion can be extended to groups as well, and you can see where I'm going. This takes us right back to Tolstoy's definition of art as the evocation of communication, and links us back to the experience often articulated in group relations. In a discussion describing inter- or multicultural dialogues, which is often a key dynamic in the here and now of a group relations conference, Wheeler, another Gestalt practitioner, says that dialogue in this format means a particular kind of conversation in which the goal is not limited to expressing your perceptions or position, but rather focuses on clarifying the sources and meanings of the various points being expressed. Not just what you want or believe, but also why that particular thing is important to you. The interaction that organizes the activity and experience is not prevailing, but deep understanding. Returning to spatial vocabulary, but still drawing on Gestalt, this means a shift in focus from the figure to the ground. Not only position yourself, not your position itself, but where you're coming from, what the meaning of the figure is to you, in relation to your own grounds of beliefs, values, goals, expectations, and loyalties. This attitude of dialogue is an expression of ethics in group relations and contributes to the aesthetic experience, which is group relations. I'm going to say now something about the art of learning, experience, and freedom. And I'm turning to another German social theorist, Theodor Adorno, who considered capitalism to be seizing of freedom and art as a domain where freedom can be attained. It is, of course, a powerful idea that experience of freedom expresses itself as aesthetic, with powerful socio-political implications, and we won't go into that near, but I think we did actually touch on that a little bit in the capitalism discussion that came out yesterday. When I open the Leicester conference, I always talk about the key concepts of the conference title, authority, role, organization, and link them to freedom. I always say about authority that it is the embodied experience, which often is exciting and frightening at the same time, which sometimes can be a spiritual experience, and which is often non-verbal or hard to articulate. The experience we have when we are able to make sense of a role we have taken up or found ourselves in, when meaning emerges, when we have a sense that we are authors of our own actions. I also like to differentiate authority from power. Whereas authority is an action taken up with integrity through the understanding of the complexity of role and purpose, the use of power draws more directly on hierarchical or financial strength or weakness. I say to the conference membership and to the staff, they will have opportunities to experience and experiment with the different ways each of us mobilize our power and authority. For example, how we take advantage or not of our heritage, our organizational position, our gender, our sexual orientation, familial roles, age, education, financial circumstances, political involvement, spiritual beliefs. When I talk about role, I define this concept as the bringing together of authority and political relatedness of individuals to their groups. institutions and society. In the conference, I say, people have opportunities to explore the ways in which we take up our roles, the ongoing negotiation of giving and taking, the functionality of roles, its destructive and creative capacity, and the interdependent nature of role. In defining organizations, I say, they are social constructs, and as such, they carry different symbolic resonances for everyone within them. Individual experiences of organizations are shaped by the nature of work, relationships between people and groups engaged in the work, and by the nature of individual desires and emotions. At Leicester and other organizational interventions I lead, I challenge and encourage people to think of themselves as action researchers, curiously engaged in a process of finding out and making up and learning. I always want to problematize the meaning of experience and the idea of learning as progressive. I come from an understanding of purpose as transformative. A tree is created and continuously recreating itself for the purpose of being and existing, no more or less than that. Dewey conceptualizes experience in a very similar way. Experience has a developing movement towards its own consummation, he says. Can you read this?
No.
Every integral experience moves towards a closure, an ending, since it ceases only when the energies active in it have done their proper work. This closure is a circuit of energy, is the opposite of arrest, the opposite of status. Maturation and fixations are polar opposites. Struggle and conflict may be themselves enjoyed, although they are painful, when they are experienced as a means of developing an experience. Members in that they carry it forward, not just because they are there. So in a method dedicated to the here and now, learning in the moment can be nothing but fresh and unique, yet paradoxically familiar enough to be recognized as related to our base, our history, our context, our ground. Also, I believe that learning itself is an art of finding and taking up authority. As action researchers, as agents of change and of learning, we know that learning is an experience of the body. It's a personal sense that we know through the boundaries of our skin. But paradoxically, we cannot have this individual bodily experience without the other or a group of others. So we have freedom in the choices we make. But at the same time, we are dependent upon our capacity to collaborate and have meaningful and real dialogue with other people and communities. In other words, learning is contingent upon our willingness to participate, again, to use the beautiful Dewey definition, to be artistically engaged. Just once. So when Eric Miller was busy with the human journey from dependency to autonomy, and Khalili has suggested more recently that perhaps we are busier with moving from autonomy to dependency, I would say that the art of our work lies in the ongoing process of negotiating between the two, on the boundary of contact and our ethical practice. Its beauty becomes known to us only when we keep our questions and negotiations alive. We do not collapse them into polarized positions. We do not elevate and idealize our work of art and do not encapsulate our ordinary experience, so its only place is in the museum. And we vigorously search for uniqueness and freshness in our encounters. I suggest that our work of art is our pursuit for social relevance and our quest for impact and applicability. And it is when we engage in our pursuit passionately and thoughtfully, we are evoking the aesthetic experience that we can then call group relations, conference, and method. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And when you go home, be sure to tell Eleanor I'm no better at button pushing than I am at Hebrew. We've got about 10 minutes or so for questions, comments.
I would like to tell a short story about my experience with this aesthetic art boundary, because as you know, I'm very much in that. And I had an experience as a trainee in our training program on a staff in
Can
a
couple of hear him?
So I was a trainee in our training program on a conference staff, and I was in a staff meeting, and as usual, the staff was trying to figure out in the IE what was going on in the system. And the staff was sitting at the table, mind-fucking what was going on. And I was at a flip chart in desperation with pens, just drawing as fast as I could whatever came into my head as a way to try to see what was going on. And the time boundary came. The director said, well, it's time to end our session. And a very senior staff member, whose name I won't mention, looked at me and says, well, we can stop as soon as Jack puts his crayons down. And after many psychoanalytic sessions with my analyst to explore the narcissistic wounding of that, it sort of brings to me this sort of sense that play, art, creativity, there's a kind of hostility to that in this work that's very puzzling. And an association to maybe a Freud-Jung split around what does the unconscious carry in terms of darkness or creativity, and what's your sense about that in the tradition and how that's seen?
Yeah, I didn't go into the detail of these kind of things, but I would also add on that yoga, because I've actually introduced yoga to Leicester, bringing it from India, which is also, I didn't think I'd have the time to go into that, but I think I agree with you, Jack. I think sometimes... On top of that, there's also the issue of positive transference and what you do with that in a group relations conference.
Others?
And while you were talking, I was thinking about what you had handed out, and that the early names of the conference involved using the word learning for leadership, and I was interested in the fact that the word leadership didn't come up. But also, I think I'm intrigued, because I think what you're doing is pretty radical in the sense of leaning so far around the subjective side of this, of the group relations experience, and the part that involves leadership or the construction of the organization, or a mutual consideration and a kind of a tension and a back and forth between what is subjective and and more objective, whatever that is. I mean, this gets really into hard philosophical kinds of discussions. But from what you said, with the emphasis on aesthetics and experience, I'm interested in some comments around the issues of leadership and the issue of constructing organizations for the managers who indeed come to these conferences, and how that gets pulled into the conference, if it does at all.
Yeah, I said a little bit about that in the attitude section around how do you lead in a complex world where things that around linear versus non-linear thinking, and that's partly what I do in my organizational work. Well, in my own leadership role at the Institute as well, is how do you work together with, not by a top-down hierarchy, for example. So I think it's absolutely relevant to the attitude of any leader, the leader in the form of the director of a conference, but also the leadership as it emerges in the conference, and the interdependency between leadership and followership. Mm-hmm. Is that answering your question? Not really.
I think it's larger, because I'm thinking of this as...
Longer, please.
Well, my experience of what you presented had much more to do with the issues of the experience and a kind of therapeutic side, which is an element of group relations. And I didn't hear the kind of balancing issue that is, sort of what I take with it, with regard to, all those old words, boundary, authority, role, and task, all those things that are a little bit more organizational. And I'm just curious, I'm thinking from what you presented, I was just interested in what is being represented. that makes any sense. It was, I heard more of the aesthetic subjectivity. That's what I heard more from what you were saying. And I was wondering if there was a more balancing, or if you see that this is where it's going. The movement. What I saw you presenting was more of the subjective side, and a question of whether there is some shift historically, or some shift, you know, from the way you're doing the conference and how you understand this work, as opposed to how I sort of understood it in earlier years.
I don't know. I think a lot of my work is still very much holding on to the principles of the tradition as well. I think it's... I don't know if I managed to answer your question this time, but it's something about bringing into the conference. For example, take the institutional event. I think I find it quite odd to run it in its very original form, where the management is sitting in a room somewhere and is expecting membership to come to it with hypotheses. I just find it odd. I don't think there's an organization in the world that operates like this. That's one. Second is, there's so many... When we do work with more in the private sector, obviously, than in the public sector, you do face global companies, and they work a lot with online. Their group dynamics are mostly virtual. How do you bring that to a conference in a way that if these members come to actually learn from group relations, that they can actually learn something from that? Okay. Because their reality is that they work for, I don't know, IBM or Shell or whatever else. They're working in China, but they don't speak Chinese. How do you work with the multi... I think I've had to make some adaptations, and I think we will all continue to have to make some adaptation, not only to the conferences, but also to our organizational work. You know, I have to do coaching sometimes on Skype, and I find it really difficult. My coachee finds it easier than I do. But the world where we always have the face-to-face and the small group and the time, all of that is not, it is luxurious.
I need to thank you for reminding us all of the importance of pursuing the work passionately. To me, it's about taking it out of just the intellectual realm and actually embodying it. And that's something I have found rare in many fields, not just in work group relations. So I'm curious, are you finding the same difficulty of consultants that work in Tavistock to embody what they perhaps understand intellectually, and if you are experiencing that problem, what are you doing to push this passion?
I think what happened to maybe particularly in group relations conferences is that they have become an extraordinary experience, where actually what we want people to learn is about the ordinary, everyday humdrum of the organizational life. And I think somehow maybe that has created a certain split that is very difficult. You can be very passionate about an extraordinary experience. It's very difficult to remain passionate about the everyday, ongoing, daily, repetitive activities. But what I'm trying to do is find the aesthetics, the beauty, the passion, the integrity in that, because I think that's what really keeps us going, not the extraordinary experience. That's the myth.
May I ask a follow-up? Are you finding that this message resonates? You mentioned that you get members from Exxon, from industry. Are you finding that this message resonates with them?
Yes. Well, those who come. I still think, as I said yesterday in one of the sessions, we also have not very many people in terms of percentage who come from industry. By the way, I don't know what it's like here, but in England, certainly the public sector always follows what the private sector is doing, so the merging, it's now in London, especially, well, in the UK, but in London there's a big merging wave between local authorities. So they would become a form of a global organization pretty quickly. So I don't know if it's a very useful distinction. I think people work where they work, and they bring what they bring. And I think once they're there, yes, I think people do learn.
Thank you.
But it's about the application back home and around this extraordinary and ordinary experience, which is difficult to sustain.
I want to tell a brief parable, and then I want to build on what Bernie was asking, because I'd like to understand it myself.
Jeff, can you stand up and turn that way so people can hear you? No.
Thanks. The story's brief. It's three rabbinical students who are want to visit the Great Rebbe in the town far away, and they're talking about what they want to learn. And the first one says, I really want to learn how the rabbi prays, because that's going to really be very useful to me. And the second one says, I'd really like to learn how the rabbi reads the Torah, because that's really at the center of Judaism. And the third one says, I want to visit the Rebbe because I want to learn how he ties his shoes. My understanding of what you're offering us, Eliot, in terms of the aesthetic part, I hope I'm building on what you were asking, Bernie, is that we're coming from a tradition of boundaries, authority, role, tasks. What I'm hearing you offering us is a way of understanding our approach as co-constructed with the people that we're working with. So that what you're saying, in a sense, is that there's a way that the Rebbe ties his shoes, and then there's a way that the Rebbe might learn from his students about how to tie his shoes. And that together we might learn more than if we thought that each of us has the answer ourselves. Is that...
On your parable, I would say that I'm also hopefully reminding you that the way you tie your shoes is no less important than the way you read the Torah.
Carol?
I just have an association to the kind of re-navigation you're suggesting, I think, which is the transition from the classical writers of the 17th century to the romantic writers of the 18th century. Or the 19th century, rather, I think it's very reminiscent of the sort of correction, if you will, from the classicists to the romantics. And I started trying to think about what was going on socially that gave rise to the change in literary focus, if you will. So it's just kind of an association, but all during your talk I was thinking of them and how somehow it had to move in that direction for a time. And then more freedom occurred, much more freedom of expression in literary terms after that transition. It's very interesting.
We're going to be short of time, but let's just take one question from the back there, Omar.
Yeah, I'm wondering about what's indicative of your presence and your... here in Acre, and your presentation, and building on Charles talking about the classical. And I was wondering if the kind of a boundary here with what Bernie is bringing, and what's indicative of your presence, and what I've heard in the discourse is that, and I'm asking if you feel this, is that Acre might be representing something that's classical, and Tavistock might have moved from there. And I'm wondering whether that's present in the dynamic. And if you feel that Acre is holding on to a very classical boundary, but Tavistock, in the way it interprets the group relations, have somehow moved away from that classicism. I'm wondering about that.
I don't think I know the answer to that because I haven't worked with Acre in the States. So I don't know.
Very quickly, one last question here.
Just have a question about the modernist notion of aesthetics, the positive and negative aesthetics. Seems that you're in the positive side of it. And I think that Bernie's on the negative side of it, breaking the illusion of empathy and totality wholeness.
No. I don't think I have. The point is ethics, and working is aesthetic as an experience that is coming out of an ethical practice with integrity and passion. I try to give a few because I think it's an important in my reading of the philosophers, they do actually argue against that, and they say that that has been a misunderstanding of aesthetics and of art, that it's only in touch with the positive. And by the way, a critic on psychoanalysis as well, which takes that perspective, they believe. One that I didn't go into a lot of detail around is the individual artist offers his or her projections in the work of art. So a failure to see art as socially constructed, which I think is really important, and it is group relations work. So I know this one. If that's what Bernie was trying to say, then I would have disagreed.
No, but can you say it fast?
I think what you're offering us, and I think I'm also linking to what Bernie was asking, is that leadership today is really more of an art form, and that it's an emergent thing. Or it's a thing where I think we're trying to offer a way of staying in the moment and being open to what is emerging. And that is, I think, the link to how leadership is today, which is so...
Hopes and of course.
Excuse me?
Oh, then of course. You know, it has, yeah,
well, but so the link is to, I mean, maybe I'm not answering anything, but that that it feels much more relevant to how leaders today are needing to create leaders at all levels, because there's no centralized leadership. I don't want to look at you because I'm not sure this is what you were asking. Mm-hmm. But that's what it feels, is that it's more, this experience is subjective, because it then enables us to go out to then kind of exist in that space and create leaderful people at all levels of the organization.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alain.